Hello, it's Tuesday the 27th of July and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The two Koreas have re-established communication lines for the first time in 13 months after the leaders exchanged multiple letters since April. We'll have more in our news briefing, and then later for in-depth, we'll discuss with an expert what this signals for the situation on the peninsula. Meanwhile, Team Korea picked up another bronze in judo at the Tokyo Olympics, and more medals are guaranteed for Tuesday evening. We'll have the latest on going for gold. Then on Touch Base in Seoul, we meet Julia Meller, who turned her passion for traditional Korean alcohol, or sul, into a business teaching others about it. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. Seoul and Pyongyang have reinstated their hotline 13 months after North Korea severed the channel. The re-engagement is a result of top-secret exchanges between South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un since April. Here to unpack the latest on inter-Korean relations and other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio KBS World Radio news editor Gu Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang.
So this was a surprise development, Hee-jin, with the presidential office hastily making a televised announcement at 11 a.m. this morning. Mm-hmm. While there was said to be no discussion on holding another inter-Korean summit, the news was welcomed by both ruling and opposition factions and sparked hopes that this may lead the way for North Korea to return to the negotiating table regarding its nuclear weapons program.
Indeed. The restoration comes 413 days after the North cut off all lines, including the one at the truce village of Panmunjom, amid Pyongyang's protests over anti-regime leaflets distributed by defector groups in the south, sent over to the north attached to giant balloons. The two Koreas had set up new comm channels early last year after staff members from the south were forced to abandon liaison offices in Kaesong in the north amid COVID-19 concerns. However, the channel was remained in place even after the North blew up the Kaesong liaison office building last June. And on Tuesday, the two Koreas agreed to resume twice daily phone contacts, once in the morning and another in the afternoon. The move was welcomed by ministries as well as political factions, although they differed in the degree of its reception. The Unification Ministry and the Democratic Party voiced their enthusiasm, saying that it demonstrates the two sides' commitment for lasting peace and an eventual end to the Korean War armistice of nearly seven decades. The main opposition People Power Party also hailed the move, but was more subdued. PPP spokesperson Yang Jun-woo said the channels have been repeatedly severed and reinstated unilaterally by North Korea. He said a dialogue is when two-way exchanges based on mutual respect take place, and that a one-way communication is usually called a courtship.
We'll have a deeper dive into the possible implications of this development in our in-depth news analysis segment coming up later in the show. Turning now to concerns over the persistent spread of COVID-19, South Korea has reported another record Monday figure, and health authorities are concerned that a delay in Moderna vaccine deliveries may drag on inoculation schedules. Can you break down the latest figures for us?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency on Tuesday reported 1,365 additional cases, bringing the nation's cumulative tally to 191,531. It is the highest Monday figure since the start of the epidemic, and the total has not dipped below 1,000 for 3 weeks. The number of cases that occurred in the Seoul metro area accounted for 60.4% of local infections, while that of the non-greater metro area stood at 39.6%, indicating that the fourth wave is indeed spreading to all corners of the nation. This has prompted non-metro municipal governments to toughen distancing protocols to level 3, which forces establishments such as restaurants and cafes to close at at 10 p.m. What is adding to concern is a delay in Moderna vaccine shipments that may push back vaccination plans for those aged between 18 to 49, which may hamper the government's goal of giving at least one shot to 70% of the nation's population by September. Moderna said the batch initially slated to arrive in South Korea late July will be delivered next month due to production setbacks. The government will unveil on Friday inoculation schedules for some 22 million people in that age bracket. They account for 50% of 44 million people in Korea above the age of 18 who are scheduled to receive shots under the government's mass inoculation scheme.
Yes, and we will, of course, keep an eye on developments on that front. And meanwhile, some welcome news. South Korea's tidal flats have finally been officially listed as a UNESCO World Natural Heritage. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the Cultural Heritage Administration said on Monday that UNESCO's World Heritage Committee made the decision to include the tidal flats, or Gyetbol, as they are called in Korea, on the list in its 44th session in Fuzhou, China, with unanimous approval by all of its 21 member nations. The committee said the tidal flats serve as an important habitat for biodiversity, recognizing outstanding universal value for providing a stopover for migratory birds. The decision comes as a surprise, as the tidal flats were deferred from the list of potential World Heritage assets in a preliminary review in May.
And finally, K-pop megagroup BTS have made history yet again with its single Butter, grabbing back its number one spot on Billboard's main singles chart, replacing its follow-up hit Permission to Dance in just 1 week.
Indeed, BTS' second English track, Butter, has reclaimed its spot on this week's Hot 100 chart and has now tied with Olivia Rodrigo's Driver's License for the longest-running number one song in 2021. The song was at the top of the chart for 7 straight weeks before it was replaced by BTS's own Permission to Dance last week, and which slipped to the 7th spot. Butter returned to the top spot for an 8th week, and the Billboard said BTS is the first artist ever to top the chart, replacing themselves on the Hot 100 chart. Then have the previous song returned to number one without having a song by another artist go number one in between.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
It's time now for Going for Gold, our special daily segment covering the latest from Team Korea at the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. Joining me in the studio for that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who has been following all the action. Mark, it's great to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Okay, it's been a bit of a mixed bag of results, shall we say, for Team Korea over the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But let's start with the positives. Team Korea picked up a bronze medal on Monday evening in the men's judo. Can you tell us more about it, Mark?
Sure, absolutely. Tokyo-born An Chang-rin defeated Rustam Orujov of Azerbaijan in the men's under 73-kilogram event to grab bronze. It was in the sudden-death extended golden school period, and An scored a beautiful over-the-head wrist-lock throw to score Wasari. Hmm. You and I saw the replays. It was impressive. He didn't even grab the sleeve. It was just, I don't know, technique.
So much energy. It was a fantastic finish and a really hard-fought campaign as well. I saw his semi-final loss early in the day, and that was so heartbreaking to see. But then it was great to see him come back and take that bronze like he did. Mm-hmm. So another bronze for Team Korea, meaning a total of 7 medals so far, 3 gold and 4 bronze medals. We actually know for sure that Team Korea will be tacking on 2 or 3 more medals by the end of tonight, Tuesday. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting to see Which color they'll be, Mark.
Yes, absolutely right. Team Korea has been struggling a little bit in the fencing events, so it's wonderful to hear that we will fight for gold in the women's epee team event. They're going to begin their battle against Estonia at 7:30 p.m. Mm. Then in Taekwondo, in the over 67 kilogram event, Lee Da-bin will fight for a gold at 9:30 p.m. against Serbia. You and I, we watched together the dramatic finish to the semifinals where she scored a head kick at the very last millisecond to take the win against Great Britain's Bianca Walkden. Mm. It was with authority. It was incredible, right? And we also have a chance to add one more medal to the board as In Gyeldon will fight for bronze in the over 80 kilogram category in Taekwondo. That's at 8:45.
Okay, so more medals on the way. That is encouraging to hear.
Yeah.
However, it wasn't all good news today for Team Korea, especially for its younger stars. Now, one of the athletes that has made a name for himself over the last few days was the young archer, Kim Jae-deok.
Yeah.
He endeared himself to fans not only for his passionate cries of Korea fighting during the team events, but also for his incredible skill he has shown in those events as well.
That's right.
But he felt disappointingly short today, Mark. Can you tell us more?
Indeed, the fiery teen archer prodigy, his flames were quelled today after he was eliminated in the men's individual event at the hands of Germany's Florian Unruh. Now, we cannot discount the 17-year-old's performance, however, and we well know that he won't be leaving the games empty-handed as he won two gold medals, one in the brand-new mixed team event with An San, and the other in the men's team event. So, hey, he's done an incredible
job. He's definitely an incredible job. It would have been incredible, of course, to see him take three gold medals out of three, but no matter, he's done an incredible job, and everyone's proud of him, and he's, as I said, won the hearts of many with his youthful, fiery energy as well.
Yeah, that's right.
The rest of the Korean archers continue their elimination rounds from tomorrow, so there's still medal chances there. Let's talk about another young prodigy, though, this time in the sport of swimming, Hwang Sun-woo. Now, many tuned in to watch the men's 200-meter freestyle event today, and for a while it looked like he was going to win it.
Man, I mean, this was an event that had people on the edge of their seats. I was not even sitting. I was standing the entire time. And he had an incredible start off the line. In fact, as you said, he was at the head of the pack for the majority of the race. At one point, he was at a world record pace. But alas, in the final 50 meters, it seemed he may have gassed out a bit as he was overtaken and finished in seventh. But again, he's not out of the games yet as he has other events left.
Yes, shorter lengths as well. It was incredible to see him match world record pace for that first half of the race, but he's perhaps better suited then for shorter lengths. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see how he performs in those shorter races. And there's one more rising star that we wanted to talk about today. She is out of one event, but still involved in another, and she has already shown massive potential throughout these games, hasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, that's 17-year-old Shin Yu-bin, someone I've been really keeping a close eye on as she's advanced to the women's singles table tennis event. She lost today in the third round to Hong Kong, but Shin, she should be lauded in her performance throughout the games. Notably, her match on Sunday against 58-year-old Ni Xia Lian of Luxembourg, that's a 41-year-old age difference. Now, at such an age, Shin will have plenty of competitions ahead of her, and she definitely has the country behind her. Even BTS, I believe, he sent out an SNS message to support her, whereas Shin, I believe he's her favorite member.
Right, so, exactly. Yeah. She's a confessed BTS fan. So in response, BTS sent her a message, which I thought was very touching.
And she's not out of the games yet, and she's going to compete in the women's team event on Sunday. So keep an eye on her.
Definitely. Okay, so we talked about three young guns, and despite their losses, how they have shown potential and excited fans. Let's talk about a veteran now, who had hoped to write his name into the history books, but sadly fell short as well, and that is the decorated South Korean shooter, Jin Jong-woo. He will be returning home without a medal.
Yes, after being knocked out of the qualifiers in the men's 10-meter air pistol, and today in the mixed team with Chu Ga-eun, he will remain tied as the country's most decorated Olympian, and will have to wait to grab a medal. Now, I use the word wait because the 41-year-old hasn't said anything about retirement, and let's remember, it's the 50-meter air pistol where he excels. So if that event pops up in 2024 in Paris, who knows? I mean, a fencer came out of retirement. He got bronze this games. Why not? You know, totally possible.
Right. He'll be 44 for the 2024 games. That really would be extraordinary. But knowing his determination and, should we say, stubbornness, it's certainly possible. We talked earlier about the table tennis player from Luxembourg, Ni Xia Lian, who is 58 years old. That's incredible as well. So she shows it can be possible. So we really can't rule him out yet. Okay, Mark, let's end with events we have to look out for tomorrow. What can you tell us?
Well, medals up for grabs tomorrow is in the men's saber team event, so that's fencing, and men's and women's judo. Remember, as I said yesterday, it goes up in weight class as each day progresses. In gymnastics, Lee Jun-ho will also represent Team Korea in tomorrow's men's artistic individual all-around event, so really keep an eye out for him. Mm. Now, more archery, as you said, individual in eliminations, both in men's and women's, will go down as well, so keep an eye out for Team Korea. And the men's football team will face off against Honduras, as I said earlier in the week, for Team Korea's last Group B match. They're going to need at least a tie against Honduras to advance. Mm.
So the events keep rolling on. Mm. We'll leave it there for today's Going for Gold, Mark. Thank you for that roundup, and we'll catch up with you again tomorrow.
Okay.
In a sudden and unexpected televised announcement on Tuesday morning, the presidential office revealed that the two Koreas had decided to restore communication channels and that it had reopened at 10 a.m. This comes more than 13 months after North Korea unilaterally severed the line in protest to propaganda leaflets sent by defector groups from the south. The presidential office said that the reopening of lines was a result of an agreement between President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un after multiple letter exchanges since April, communicating on improving inter-Korean relations. To analyse what this sudden development might mean for the situation on the peninsula, as well as the deadlocked denuclearization talks between the US and North Korea, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Kwon Myung-hyun, Senior Fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies. Dr. Go, thank you for speaking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your immediate reaction to the news that the communication lines had been restored? Were you surprised?
So, yeah, I was a little bit surprised by the sudden announcement, even though it wasn't entirely unexpected. But what really surprised me was the fact that this announcement came at this time rather than a couple of months ago when probably it was more advantageous for the North Koreans to agree to restoring the communication line. I say this because had North Korea and South Korea had agreed to reconnect the communication line, say before President Moon Jae-in went to Washington, D.C. for his first summit with President Biden, the impact of this announcement would have been so much more powerful. But this thing didn't come to be, and then the timing of the announcement came now, and there's, I think, some questions among experts, why now?
Mm. Sure. So we'll get to why now, but according to the presidential office, President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had exchanged letters since April to try and communicate on improving inter-Korean relations. What do you think that tells us, Dr. Go?
So I think it arguably demonstrates the persistence on the part of President Moon to somehow continue the diplomatic efforts with North Korea, despite the fact that North Korea has been quite hostile to such initiative in the past, as we already know, and we have to give him credit for that. But I think this persistence on the part of President Moon allowed North Korea to think about ways to use inter-Korean relations for strategic purposes and strategic ends. And I think their action now shows that the North Koreans are thinking about how to restart not just the inter-Korean dialogue, but also as the negotiation with the United States. I think just like North Koreans did back in 2018 when they outsourced, quote-unquote, the responsibility of starting and maintaining dialogue between Pyongyang and Washington to South Korea, I think that some similar move is taking place right now. And I think President Moon would very much like to, I would even say eager to assume the role again, just like he did back in 2018. Mm. But between Kim Jong-un and President Biden.
As you said, President Moon had been persistent and South Korea had been looking to engage in more dialogue with North Korea, but there had been little sign up to now that North Korea was willing to reciprocate. What do you think might have changed? Why do you think North Korea have now agreed to restoring these inter-Korean communication lines?
So I think restoration of the inter-Korean communication line at this juncture is really revealing of what North Koreans have in mind for the future, especially when it comes to not just to their attitude towards South Korea, but also towards Washington. I think this says a lot more about their approach towards Washington with the new president there, President Biden. I believe what's going on is that for North Koreans to essentially take a long view of the game now. What I mean by this is that instead of using provocations to elicit very quick response from Washington, they actually now they are taking a very long-term view of things. So instead of mounting a major show of force, for instance, to essentially force the United States back to the negotiation table in terms of negotiation that's actually beneficial to North Koreans. This time, North Koreans are going back to the drawing board and taking a very cautious step, very small steps, but then step-by-step approach towards restarting the dialogue with Washington. I think that they are unsure what the Biden administration's attitude towards North Korea is still. There's uncertainty about that from their point of view. So they are essentially minimizing the risk of failure of another round of dialogue in Washington by going through Seoul rather than directly to Washington.
Okay, so perhaps they're testing the water to see what more they can get from the situation. Could this be a precursor then to something more significant, perhaps a summit maybe between the two Koreas?
So could be, but then I think we have to look back what happened in 2018 to in order to gauge what could be happening in the future. I think back in 2018, we witnessed a very rapid escalation of progress in the inter-Korean dialogue, but that didn't take place in the vacuum. Such a rapid progress was made possible only because the Pyongyang-Washington dialogue was also evolving very fast, thanks to the fact that President Trump was taking a very unorthodox approach to North Korea. So in a way, North Koreans rewarded President Moon for the success of their success a bit in sitting across the table from the sitting vice president. And I think the same thing would happen now. So what I mean by this is if North Korea and President Biden decide to re-enter into a cycle of negotiations, and if there's going to be a rapid progress like the one that we witnessed between Kim Jong-un and President Trump back in 2018, then we see a corresponding progress in the Korean dialogue this time too. So unless that happens, it's unlikely that Kim Jong-un is going to agree to another round of summit with President Moon when President Moon is off, terms of office is going to end next year.
Right. There was this thinking that perhaps time was running out for President Moon with his term ending next year. But does this show that there is still perhaps a role that President Moon can play?
Clearly, the North Koreans think so. And I think they are giving President Moon another chance. But then I think both the North Koreans as well as President Moon understand that President Moon has a very small window of opportunity this time. It's very critical for the United States to somehow be very enthusiastic about this change of attitude from North Korea. But if the U.S. response to this is lackadaisical, then chances that we are going to see a very quick return to the normal state of affairs between Pyongyang and Washington these days, which is an impasse.
Do you think if there's any suggestion that of desperation by North Korea as well? There are talks about perhaps the COVID-19 outbreak spreading in North Korea and economically suffering with famines. Do you think that this is perhaps a reach out by North Korea?
Well, it would have been a reach out by North Korea to South Korea and by extension to the United States had the North Korean relations with China and Russia been quite bad, and that's not the case. If North Korea wanted a major assistance from the outside, they can first go to Beijing and Moscow. But they haven't done that. So I think that in the outreach effort by North Korea this time, if we can call it that way, it's driven by some other logic. I think it's strategic rather than a need for a humanitarian assistance. So I think that's why we shouldn't really misjudge North Korean move this time by thinking that North Koreans are getting desperate, they need aid. I think that's going to lead to a wrong conclusion about North Korean motivation.
Is there also danger that we sometimes read too much significance into this sort of development? That is just perhaps another example of North Korea playing hard to get, the usual pattern of showing engagement 1 month and then fierce rhetoric another.
So we are clearly seeing some elements of that this time too. After all, what the two Koreas agreed to resume this time was to just to reconnect the communication line. Essentially, North Koreans expressed their willingness to pick up the phone if South Koreans called. So in that sense, it's a very minor move. If you can call it concession, yes, it's a very minor concession on the part of North Koreans. But North Koreans understand that what they're playing is not a military game or even a political game. It's a strategic game. So they understand that once agreeing to resume or restore the communication line, it's going to have it's going to be amplified and again by the news cycle, and then it's going to have a disproportionate impact on the opinions in Seoul and Washington. So they definitely understand this mechanism, and therefore they want Seoul and Washington to react or even overreact to their minor action.
Right, so this is perhaps one small step to perhaps the bigger picture for denuclearization talks between the United States and North Korea. What do you think the U.S. and South Korea should do next?
So again, as I said, we shouldn't really misjudge North Korean motivation here. North Koreans are playing a diplomatic game. It's a very small game here, and that's why they made a very small gesture. So we have to reciprocate in the same way. I think being skeptical about North Korea's ultimate motivation is probably positive in this case, especially because the prefer intermediary by North Koreans, President Moon's terms of office, is going to end very soon, relatively speaking. So things could be quite different around this time next year. So I think all the major players involved, especially the United States, will understand this is there are limitations to North Koreans' outreach effort this time. So, and I think what's going to happen is that North United States government is going to, it's not going to be express enthusiasm for dialogue right away. They are going to assume this wait and see attitude and wait until North Koreans reveal more of what their intention is, what their motivation is this time. I think then the United States government is going to respond accordingly. And that's something that President Moon's of our government should also understand, that there's not going to be a major quick uptake in the Korean dialogue and then Washington-Pyongyang dialogue this time.
Right, so this is an interesting concession, but we have to be cautious about what to expect. We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Dr. Kwon Myung-hyun from the ASEAN Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 7.58 points or 0.24% on Tuesday, closing the day at 3,232.53. Tech-heavy KOSDAQ fell, however, losing 1.08 points, or 0.10%, to close at 1,046.55. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 4.91 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,150.1 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Welcome back. Next up, it's Korea Trending, a daily roundup of some of the other news stories that have been grabbing the attention of readers online in Korea Today. And bringing us those stories, it's the turn of Lee Joo-young, who joins us on the line now. Joo-young, hello.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So, what do you have in store for us today, Joo-young?
Our first story is about the latest countermeasure against soaring real estate acquisitions by foreign buyers. We then talk about how the remains of a South Korean climber were recently found in the Himalayas over 20 years later. Our last story is about how an Olympian may have lost a medal but gained a life partner.
Okay, so to begin with, we have some new countermeasures that have been proposed against foreign buyers of real estate in Korea. Can you tell us more?
Sure. We'll start with the rising concerns over real estate purchases by non-Koreans. Soaring property purchases by foreign buyers have been an issue of concern for some time in South Korea, and a group of lawmakers have proposed a bill that places restrictions on property purchase by foreign buyers. South Korea is relatively lenient on real estate acquisitions by foreign buyers in the area of restrictions, and such practice has recently come under fire as recent data showed foreigners bought over 7,900 houses over the last 5 years in Seoul alone, nearly half of which were purchased by Chinese buyers.
I see. So can you tell us about this proposed bill then? What does it stipulate?
Led by Representative Taeyong-ho of the conservative main opposition People Power Party, 19 lawmakers pushed for the bill that seeks to apply the principle of reciprocity on real estate purchases by foreigners in South Korea, according to country. The bill also calls for government authorization for foreigners' real estate acquisitions in overheated speculation-prone districts. If passed, it's expected to prevent disturbances in the market caused by real estate purchases by foreign nationals and further help in stabilizing South Korea's real estate market.
I see. So further measures to cool down the real estate market. We'll see if it does get passed. But the fact that it was trending today again shows how sensitive a topic rising real estate prices is in Korea currently. Chuyong, let's move on to our second story now. What are we looking at?
Our second story is about the dramatic turn of events in the Himalayas. While the search for missing climber Kim Hong-bin was suspended yesterday upon his family's request, it was reported on Monday that the body of another South Korean climber, Ho Seung-kwan, who went missing in 1999, was found. According to the Foreign Ministry, Ho's body was found by a team of foreign mountaineers earlier this month near the base camp of Broad Peak in the Karakoram Mountains. This is the same location where Kim Hong-bin went missing last week. It was a development separate from the search efforts for Kim Hong-bin, and it's known to be very rare to find the remains of a missing mountaineer decades after.
Right, so the discovery of Ho's body was unrelated to the search for Kim Hong-bin, but that is quite the coincidence. You said Ho went missing in 1999. That's 22 years already now. Can you tell us more about how Ho went missing?
Sure. Ho was only 27 when he went missing. He was a member of the Yonsei University climbing group in Seoul and was on his way to conquer the Broad Peak in 1999 with late legendary climber Park Young-seok leading the team. But they gave up climbing at 7,300 meters above sea level and were on their descent when Ho went missing. Ho's body was found as the snow briefly melted earlier in July, and his identity was confirmed through his other remains, such as the Yonsei team jacket and flags. The Yonsei climbing team plans to send a member to the site to collect his remains.
Well, with Ho's remains coming back to Korea, I'm sure the climber's family will finally be able to get some closure. You mentioned how rare it is for a missing climber to be found again years after they go missing on the mountains. Mm-hmm. It is indeed very rare, isn't it?
Quite rare, but not unheard of. In July 2019, two bodies of South Korean climbers who went missing in the Himalayas in 2009 were found. Sadly, the legendary climber Park Young-seok, whom I spoke of earlier, also went missing while trying to develop a new route called the Korea Route on the south face of Annapurna, Nepal in 2011 and has yet to be found.
Well, perhaps his and other missing climbers will be found again sometime in the future. It shows how dangerous these mountains can be, but I think it also shows the incredible passion that these men had for what they do. Okay, let's turn to our final story now, and we're going back to the Tokyo Olympics, Jiyoung.
Our last story is about fencer Maria Belen Perez Maurice, who represented Team Argentina in women's saber at the 2020 Tokyo Games. Perez Maurice had just lost to Anna Martin of Hungary when her coach and boyfriend of 17 years, Lucas Guillermo Saucedo, proposed to her.
Right, and he did it on camera as well while she was being interviewed. Yes. I guess that's one way to change your mood after a loss. I understand this footage has gone viral now as well, understandably.
Yes, it sure has. The video that's making the rounds is a live TV interview with Perez Maurice. As she reflects over her performance, Saucedo appears in frame behind her, holding up a sign that read, "Will you marry me, please?" It wasn't until the reporter asked her to turn around did she see Saucedo's proposal. And guess what, Jang-ho? She accepted.
Okay, that's good to know. It would have been very awkward otherwise. You said the two had been dating for a long while. Was Saucedo always going to propose like this?
Not entirely. Coach Saucedo said his proposal wasn't planned at all, but he wanted to lift Maurice's spirit after she lost the match. So even without a ring, he hastily found a piece of paper and wrote the big question. But it seems he did have a proposal in mind, as he later said he would have waited if Maurice had won the event. This was, in fact, not the first time he proposed. That happened after the 2010 World Fencing Championships in Paris, but she opted to hold things off. Paris Maurice said they will celebrate their engagement in Buenos Aires with a big barbecue.
Well, hopefully it won't be held off this time. Now, I heard this wasn't the only proposal made during the Tokyo Olympics.
That's right. After helping Germany take a 3-2 win over Saudi Arabia, Union Berlin star Max Kruse proposed to his girlfriend on live TV. In his post-match interview, he took off his jersey to show his shirt that translated to, "I love you, would you like to marry me?" She was most definitely watching, as she reportedly said yes.
Well, that's good to hear, too. We wish them all a happy wedding and marriage. That wraps up today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Jung, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Now, we have talked before on Korea 24 how there's more to the culture of Korean alcohol than those ubiquitous green bottles of soju. There is a whole world of Korean spirits, wine and drinks out there. And today on Touch Base in Seoul, we have another guest who has fallen for that world, so much so that she started her own business dedicated to the education of Korean traditional alcohol, or sul, and it's called the Sul Company. I'm delighted to say that Ms. Julia Meller has joined us in the studio today to tell us about that and her Sul journey. Ms. Meller, thank you for being here with us today.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us first a little bit about yourself? How long have you been in Korea and what first brought you to Korea?
Well, these days I try and stop counting because it means how old I'm getting. But I have been in Korea for about 15 years now. I actually came, as many people did, was just to teach English and to have a new experience after graduating university.
Right.
And I taught a couple of years, and I actually got into radio for a while and did a couple of things in Korea, which I loved. But about 10 years ago, I discovered quality Korean alcohol, quality makgeolli, I guess you would say. And I pretty much fell in love with it. I'd had soju before, I'd had makgeolli before, but I'd always thought, okay, this is a means to an end in a lot of ways. But then when I tried all this quality stuff, I was like, oh my goodness, this is actually really, really good. Why is there no information about it? And that was sort of the raindrop that started the waterfall of my journey into being a specialist in the field.
So before that time, about 10 years ago, you had had Korean alcohol, for example, soju, as you talked about, and other types of makgeolli. But then what was that discovery of the better sul? How was that experience like?
That was really eye-opening to me because I, and like many people that come to Korea for the first time, they think that soju and makgeolli are just a brand almost. They're almost synonymous with the green bottle or with what you can get in a convenience store. I had no idea that there was variety, there was different ABVs, there were different flavors and things like that. So I actually had a blind tasting, which was put on by the academy that I now teach at.
Right.
And it was just a complete different window. And I had asked the professor that was giving the tasting at the time, why is there no information about this? Why is there not more? I would have made better drinking choices if I'd if I'd known about that. And he just sort of looked at me and said, well, if you're not busy, I mean, why don't you do it? And that was the seed, and here I am.
Okay, that was the seed. How did you develop that seed then? Where did you go next with that?
So I did start off as a drinker. I think that's usually the entry level. I was definitely into discovering more about them and just trying different types. So this is when we started a community, a meetup community, which was called, originally it was actually called Makgeolli Mamas and Pajon Papas. But we dropped the Pajon. For some reason, we thought that was too long. But then we basically opened up this community. So every 3 weeks, we would say, anyone in Seoul, if you want to come and join us, we pick the place, come and arrive, and we would order all the makgeollis on the menu, and we had rating sheets, and we'd all write down what we thought, and at the end of the evening, I would collect them, and then make a average review of everyone, what everyone thought about it, and put it on the website. So it was a learning experience, but also a social experience, and then I found pretty much a year or two in that I wasn't learning with everybody, I was actually teaching everybody.
Right.
And that was definitely a defining change.
Right, so the makgeolli mamas and papas is pretty much where you started. But as you said, that was a social community rather than a company as such.
Yes.
So then let's get into the company did form in the end, the Seoul company. How did those experiences before lead you to establish a company dedicated to Korean alcohol?
Right. Well, I mean, I will say it wasn't easy to change from community of offering free services and just being social to change into a commercial entity. But it was a natural progression because actually I'm a specialist in Seoul, but I'm also a teacher of fermentation. So in order to prepare for that, I've always been keenly aware that I'm not Korean.
Right.
And then I essentially am the first person to be disseminating this information in English. So I have to be not just right. I have to be really, really right.
So you have that responsibility. You feel
it's a heavy shoulder burden. I mean, I triple check everything every time I'm giving any information out. So I spent a good 5 years during that time of not just MMPK, but also studying. So I learned Korean. I studied at all the different schools for fermentation, and really crossed my T's and dotted my I's about what I wanted to learn. And then it became a jump into, okay, we need to rebrand. We're not just makgeolli anymore as well. We were doing soju and cheongju and kwashiju and all these things. And it was a very conscious move to the Seoul company because also we need to have a word that describes Korean alcohol. We can't keep saying Korean traditional alcohol all the time. We just say beer, we just say wine, and essentially actually we just say sake. And actually, an interesting story, the word sake does not mean Japanese traditional alcohol. It means alcohol in Japanese language. So in the same way that su means alcohol in Korean language, it actually comes from two characters, su meaning water and pu meaning fire. And thousands of years ago, when the ancestors brewed, it would bubble and create CO2. So they thought that it had unlocked fire water. So it has these rich, the word su, even now it means beer, wine, whiskey, whatever. It actually originated from makgeolli, from brewing with rice. So we made a conscious decision to move away from the community and to rebrand and say, now we offer services, but also let's start calling Korean alcohol Seul in English, because 5 years, 10 years, 100 years from now, we don't want to be saying Korean traditional alcohol. We want to be saying Seul, which is makgeolli, soju, cheongju, all those beautiful things.
Right. It definitely sounds like you've done your homework, laid the groundwork, and really thought about this issue. I think that's so fascinating, that the fact that we call Japanese sake sake, but we don't have a word as such until we think about it. Why not call it suru?
Exactly. It was a logical progression, but also, as you know, makgeolli doesn't spell very well in English, and it really gets mispronounced everywhere. So actually, suul is one of the easier ones to spell, and it's very adaptable. So we're hoping that it catches on as well as we hope it'll catch on. So,
you mentioned that you offer services with your company. What kind of services do you offer?
Well, pre-corona, which is a buzzword of the times these days, we were very heavily into tourism. So we would offer tasting tours and brewery tours and events and things like that, and really connect the experiential part. Because during my time of studying, I'm very close with a lot of artisan breweries. And my passion really at the end of the day is I want the Korean alcohol industry to grow. And I want to help the artisans reach a market that perhaps they would have no access to. So it's all about craft for me. So we did a lot of that and classes, brewing classes. But now mostly what I focus on is consulting, where I actually help people open makgeolli breweries internationally. Because as you might know, makgeolli is unpasteurized. So it is unshippable. It is not possible to export good quality makgeolli. So I really believe the future of the expansion is in breweries in other countries that are locally produced, but also adhere to certain practices and traditions and things like that. So it's a conscious shift now into helping other people produce their own.
For the uninitiated into Korean alcohol, how would you describe it? What makes it beautiful in your eyes?
There's how much time we got? There's so many things that I really do love about it. But I think it's really in simplicity. The three ingredients to make makgeolli are rice, water, and nuruk, which is the fermentation starter for making this alcohol. It's unique to all of the other Asian alcohols that also use rice. But it's wild and it's expressive, and you can make multiple categories out of the same drink. So if you've got those three ingredients, you don't really have to be a scientist. You don't have to be really careful in the same way you do with beer and with wine. You can actually make it in your own home in the same way that it's a very home holistic way. One of my favorite stories about Seoul is that it was considered more like cooking. In the same way that every woman in the household, every matriarch, would provide the gochujang, the doenjang, the kimchi, she would also have su as part of her repertoire in the category. So it's very forgiving in that way in terms of production, but it's got so much heart and soul into the production and also your expression. You can do so many things with it. So every day, it's a new day in terms of possibility with su.
During the corona times, we've seen this explosion of people who are doing things in their own home, like making sour bread. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, why not make makgeolli as a next trend?
It's a no-brainer for me. And actually, that's what that was my first pivot last year. I mean, it was a rough time. No tourism, no tourists. Mm. You know, but what are you going to do? It's not like I'm ever going to give up on this. So it's a lifestyle choice. So that was my first foray, actually, into online classes. And I am still developing more and more additions to the courses because they've been very popular and people are now looking. It's not just something to do in your house. There is a big shift in the world in terms of knowing what you put in your body. And fermentation is a huge industry. People want better gut health. They want to be seeing something grow from beginning to end. And makgeolli fits perfectly into that. Anyone can be a brewer. Anyone can. You don't need a lot of skill. You need a lot of skill to be really good. But anyone can try making good soul.
Do you think attitudes towards Korean alcohol has changed over the years? Even within Korea, I feel like people are getting more interested in not just those green bottles, but more as well. They're looking for more.
It's a total shift. It's a total shift. I've been doing this for 10 years. When I started there, I could count on one hand how many craft breweries were out there commercially. In the last couple of years, in the last 3 years, we've seen upwards of 50 or 60 new breweries open every year. And what is the huge shift is that they're younger. There's less of that older family passed down tradition and young people wanting to become brewers, but also to put their stamp on a traditional Korean product. And so that is transferring to the drinking culture because there's different branding, there's different bars, there's all the part of an industry is there's the message to the customer. So a way to drink and eat and experience, and then also the producers want to be connected with their customers. So it is a totally different world. I even find it hard to keep up when before it was super easy, but I am trolling the internet every day to try and keep up. So it's great.
It's been so fascinating to learn about your passion for Korean alcohol, and I think you're a fantastic spokesperson for it as well. Finally, though, what's next for you and the company?
Well, I mean, we're watching and waiting on the numbers because COVID really has hindered us quite a little bit. But I really am focusing more on the online space. So I will be releasing a new masterclass course in our online courses and also how to make nuruk. Because one of the biggest challenges in Korean alcohol is you need nuruk, and that's not exactly something you pop into, you know, your local grocery store in America to get. So you can actually make that yourself. So I'm focusing on the online courses, and I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty busy with my portfolio of consulting clients. So continuing to provide the best services there.
Well, I hope our listeners do get to enjoy your masterclass videos and they try making makgeolli themselves at home. We've been speaking to Julia Meller from the Sul Company. Thank you once again for your time today.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. We'll be back same time tomorrow with more news, views and reviews from Korea, as well as the latest from Team Korea in Tokyo, of course. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and as always, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Don't even think about checking that message or texting back. Did you know it only takes 3 seconds after a driver's attention has been diverted from the road for a crash to occur? Texting while driving is 6 times more likely to cause an accident than driving under the influence of alcohol. Sending or reading a text message causes drivers, on average, to take their eyes off the road for 5 seconds. When driving at 80 kilometers per hour, that means that drivers travel approximately the length of a football field with their eyes closed. At KBS World Radio, we value our listeners' safety and well-being. If you're listening to our programs while driving via a mobile device, please hit play before you set off on your journey. If you receive a message or call while driving, either use a hands-free Bluetooth device to respond or wait until you've arrived at your destination. You're not just putting your life at risk. Distracted driving accounts for approximately 25% of all motor vehicle crash fatalities. Arrive alive.
Thank you.